You're listening to the Real Estate Runway podcast, powered by Quattro Capital, where we're all about alternative business and investment strategies to help you amplify life and maximize wealth. Here's your host, Chad, the investment maverick.
All right. Real Estate Runway family, welcome to another episode of the Real Estate Runway podcast. I'm your host, Chad Sutton, and we're here with Frank Rode today with Ownify, and I'm so excited for a game-changing conversation in the housing industry that we're going to have today. Before we bring him on the show and start talking about this amazingness, if you get any value out of this show or anything that we do here at Quattro and Real Estate Runway, share it, like it, subscribe it, swipe it, wherever you're watching it, just do something to it. And that will tell the algorithm that you liked it, and that will pay it forward so somebody else can get this free content that we do just for people like you. So pay it forward. Don't be selfish. We appreciate the heck out of you. Frank, welcome to the show. Good to have you on, brother. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Chad. Nice to see you, and excited to be here.
Yes, folks, we were nerding out about our 4K cameras here a moment ago, so we're hoping we're coming through crisp and you can see every defect in our faces if you're looking at us on YouTube. If not, you can imagine them. So we're both bearded, ugly.
You don't have that algorithm that makes you look younger and better?
I don't need it, baby. I don't need it. This is no accident, you know? So Frank, before we get into what Ownify is doing, give me your backstory, man. Like what you've done some amazing things in life and business. Walk me through all of it and end with what you're doing at Ownify, if you don't mind.
Sure. All right. Where do I start? All the way back. I was born in Germany and grew up there, came to the US for college, went to school on the East Coast in Philadelphia, Penn. The Wharton undergrad program. And so had always wanted to, you know, come to the US and live in the US, and then ended up making that work. And then joined a consulting firm on the West Coast, and I'm still here in San Francisco. So I'm one of the few people who've been in San Francisco for a long time. And you know, through that really got into financial services, kind of fintech early on, consulting in the, you know, in 99, started a company with a couple of colleagues focused on online insurance and built that up. Unfortunately, it failed. So I think we're going to talk about failures. That's definitely one of the learnings and lessons there. But got into the entrepreneurship game pretty early on and was very excited about it, right? And so this notion of starting companies, trying to figure out how do you solve a big problem and how do you do it in a way that, you know, generates a real solution for a large number of people. And quite frankly, you know, generates return to investors as well. So anyway, so that company, eCoverage, didn't work out. I worked for FICO for a while, get really deep into credit scoring, credit risk. How do the systems work that banks and lenders use? and then from there, started another company called Nomis, which is a software company, still is, that had built. And what we built ultimately was the pricing engine for lenders. And so we built that up to the point where, you know, the majority of the large US lenders, Canadian lenders, Australian lenders were using that engine to figure out how do you price a loan, how do you price a mortgage, a car loan. And so I spent 15 years deep in the bowels of mortgage math. And that is relevant to the story and kind of where we are today and what I'm doing today. So saw a lot of the data, right, that the large lenders were seeing. And as part of that, through the credit crunch and then the recovery, saw this problem more and more. And in particular, over the last couple of years, that, you know, the first time buyer was struggling in getting their foot into the first home, right? So this notion that young people in particular are having a harder and harder time getting into real estate, and decided ultimately that, you know, within the system, it's very hard to change that because by and large, the way the mortgage market works in the US is, you know, very structured, very much controlled by rules that are ultimately written by the government sponsored entities. And so there's very little flexibility that you have within that system to truly change the path and the on-ramp. And this actually then went back to kind of my story when I first came to San Francisco and looked to buy a condo at the time. I didn't have enough of a down payment, had to borrow money from my family, and they were kind enough to lend me the money. And, you know, eventually I paid them back, which it turns out, you know, 50% of first-time buyers do. So if you think about this, and this is what we started looking at, is, you know, why do you need your family's help? Why isn't there, you know, a market-based system that helps first-time buyers get into the market with a lower down payment, lower monthly payment, better affordability? And so that's what we set out to do. So ultimately ended up selling the software company and started Ownify with a mission to create a better path for first-time buyers. And so happy to double click on, you know, all the underlying reasons there, but that's kind of been the journey, right? Kind of working for the big banks and now ultimately, I wouldn't say competing with them, but trying to build an alternative and a better path, right? That helps first-time buyers in particular.
So you've been in the bowels of FICO and Nomis. So basically we could change direction here and you could tell us all how to get credit cards and bypass all the systems, right? Is that how we should do that?
Theoretically, yes. Those systems are really, really good, right? It's very hard to get around them. But I think one of the things that really we've learned, or I've learned, right, is that these companies are very large. They have existing rules, right? And everyone works within those rules. Right. And it's very hard to rethink what does ownership mean? What does, you know, how do you buy property in the US today? There's a very established way of doing that. And no one has really rethought that or challenged that. And this gets into fractional ownership, right? Which is ultimately kind of at the core of what we're trying to do with Ownify. That is very hard to do, right? And it kind of breaks a lot of the rules that the industry, lenders, mortgage lenders, you know, title companies, lawyers in the real estate space have built, and that, you know, the market has kind of been playing by for a long, long time.
So let's talk about breaking these rules. And folks, if you hear any loud knocks at the door, that's probably the SEC and the FICO people coming to haul us off for the comment that I just made. So anyway, luckily we're not live. So anyway, but let's kind of transition to that. And so I think, you know, most of us have bought homes before, but I don't want to assume anything. And I want to see the status quo of today through Frank's eyes and his mind. Okay. So before we get into how we're attempting to change the status quo and solve a problem, let's talk about what is the current way that people are buying homes, you know, from your eyes, hitting all the high points that you see are important, and why is it a problem?
Yeah. If you think about the first time buyer, right, tends to be in their maybe late 20s, early 30s. And in fact, the average age of the first time home buyer in the US keeps going up, right? It's last year, I think last statistics I saw was at 36, and it's inching up towards 40 years because more and more people are getting squeezed out. So why is that?
Hold on. So why is that? We've read papers saying, oh, the millennials just value experiences over homeownership. Is it that, or can they just not freaking afford it? What's the cause?
It's the latter. They can't afford it, right? And there's a bunch of reasons for that. And the first reason, so let's dive into this a little bit, right?
Yeah.
The first reason is home prices themselves. And everyone, you know, listening to this podcast, is aware of this, and most everyone is aware of that. Home prices keep going up. They've slowed down a little bit over the last maybe 18, 24 months as mortgage rates have gone up. But if you look at the ratio of home prices to income, they're at the highest level in 70 odd years, right? The ratio, average ratio in the US of the median home price to the median income is somewhere around 7, right? It's the highest it's ever been since records started being kept in the 30s. Right?
Now, how old is that problem? So going back to the 30s, but how old is that problem? I know the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen, 30% appreciation per year? It's been pretty wild. Is this a recent issue, or how long have you been seeing this?
It's a relatively recent issue. We've had a housing bubble, right? Obviously in the 2004, 5, 6 range prior to the crash, and house prices went up significantly then. Right. But if you look at the average over the long run, the house price to household income ratio has been around 5x, right? Okay. And it's now above 7x since really the pandemic.
That's
right? So we've seen this run up in house price to income ratio. So that's the first metric, right? And the first problem. The second problem then more recently over the last really 2 years is that mortgage rates are also at 20 plus year highs, right? So you have the cost of the home itself relative to income, and then you have the cost of the debt that you need in order to buy the home, right? So if you have mortgage rates that are in the sevens, and maybe they come down this year into the sixes, right? And, you know, everyone has their forecast and no one is good at forecasting. But, you know, the relative increase in rates from the, you know, threes that we saw post-pandemic to now 6 and 7%, right, has increased the monthly payment for the first-time buyer significantly. So you have home prices themselves. Then you have the payment required as a function of mortgage rates. You also have, for first-time buyers, significant increase over the last 10 years in student debt. So if you look at the average student debt to income ratio, that's now in the 60% or so for folks who graduate from college. Go back 10 years.
Hold on. 60% of student debt to income these days?
Student debt to income for the average college graduate. Right?
Wow.
So you go back and you think about, okay, first-time buyer, right? Maybe late 20s, early 30s, 50% or so, you know, possibly more have a college degree, right? Which is great, sets them up for income potential, but you have this drag of student debt that you have to pay back.
Frank, right? I have to put that into perspective, and you correct me if I'm wrong here. If average debt to income, let's just go averages. If average is 60%, mostly they won't lend you a home above 30%. So let's say you're around there. That's 90% of your income gone if you buy a home before you ever start to live. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, the math is maybe a little different in that it's 60% of the balance, right? So let's say you make $100,000 and you have $60,000 in student debt, right? But what a lender will do is they will look at that $60,000 student loan balance and they'll take a point, right? 1%, usually sometimes 0.5%. Yeah. Say that is the implied student loan payment, and that comes off of your DTI, your debt to income ratio, right? Or your affordability calculation, right?
Okay.
And so again, from a budget perspective, right, you've got mortgage rates that are higher, you've got house prices that are high, you have student debt that's weighing down on the average consumer, the average first time buyer. So that's three. Then the fourth thing is we've had a tax change a couple of years ago, right? That basically did away with the mortgage interest tax deduction for most first-time buyers. Because as you well know, right, you have to itemize your taxes in order to claim mortgage interest deduction. And if you're looking at the average first-time buyer who maybe makes 180, 90, 100, 120,000, right, they don't make enough to itemize their taxes. They don't pay enough in mortgage interest to make that worthwhile, so they're taking the standard deduction. So that kind of subsidy that we used to get from the federal government through mortgage interest tax deduction is no longer there. So you have that, and then you have an environment where, depending on which market you look at, you have investors and cash buyers, you know, Blackstone, BlackRock, private equity firms coming in, buying homes, and turning them into rentals, right? So a first-time buyer, we're live in Raleigh, Durham. We see this all the time, but you see it in most cities, right? You're competing against cash buyers, right? A lot of times corporate buyers. And so in that environment, the likelihood that a first-time buyer who comes in with a starter mortgage, an FHA mortgage, for example, the likelihood that that buyer wins in a competitive bid situation is very, very low, right? And so you've got all these things coming together. And it's kind of creating this perfect storm that makes it really hard for first-time buyers to get in. And yeah. So what's the net effect? You have renters staying in rentals longer. You have more people living with their parents, right? And you are delaying what is arguably the largest creation of wealth, right, for the average American by years and years and years, because people can't get into the homes that that ultimately, you know, build equity and financial security for them. So that's the core problem that we're looking to solve.
Yeah, and to tell you, folks, to tell you how big of a problem this is, recently, the corporate home buyer, the institutional home buyer, has become such a thing that if any of you who listen to me talk about commercial real estate investments all the time, we talk about cost segregation, right? Tax benefits and being able to, you know, use those to offset other gains. Well, that's also a big attractor for corporate investment in real estate. The government recently passed a resolution to where, hey, okay, if you are a large institution and you are buying over X amount of homes, you no longer get to take this kind of depreciation. And so it's gotten so bad that the policy writers are starting to try to adjust policy to deter it, because that is not their goal for housing that is built. It is not the intent for it to be gobbled up by institutions to where what Blackstone says is by 2040, you will own nothing and be happy about it, right? we're allowing that to happen in this regard. So we'll see who's right, the federal government or Blackstone. But let's keep going with this here. We've kind of set the stage for the problem. And so let's kind of turn into, what are the levers you're starting to pull to, and what do you see as the solution? Like, what is the new way that that you guys have come up with?
Yeah. So the fundamental question we asked is, why do you have to buy 100% of the home? Mm. Right? Why couldn't you buy a fraction of the home that you live in and build equity over time, but not have the obligation to ever buy 100% of the home? Hmm. Right? And why do you have to use debt to buy the home? Now, there's a bunch of advantages to debt, but there's also a bunch of disadvantages, especially for a first-time buyer. And so what we've built with Ownify is a fractional ownership platform. And the way that works in a very simple way is to say, we allow the first-time buyer to pick a home, and these are starter homes, right? So single-family homes, generally they're in the $300,000-$500,000 range, depending on the market. We allow the customer to pick the home. We execute a transaction as an all-cash buyer, right? Purchase the home, and then we fractionalize the home into 10,000 bricks. Now, a brick is a hypothetical. It's not really a brick, but it's a share. Right, an ownership share in the entity that holds title to the home. And so you're going to be familiar with this, right? Investors know this. The home actually is put into an LLC. An LLC holds title to the home. We issue 10,000 shares in that LLC. Each share is a brick, right? And the customer enters an agreement where they purchase 200 bricks, or 2%. That's the down payment, if you will, on day one. They become a bona fide member of that LLC, so they have real interest in that LLC. And they sign a five-year agreement that has three components. One component is that they build equity over those 5 years. They start with 200 bricks. And they buy roughly 13 bricks every month, to the point where after 5 years, they have 1,000 bricks, or 10% of the LLC value. At the same time, they sign a lease agreement that allows them to obviously live in the property and pay rent on the fraction of the equity on the bricks that they haven't purchased. So for the consumer, right, a simple way to think about it is to say, I have my pile of bricks and I need to rent the other pile, right? Because every house has 10,000 bricks. And so while I'm buying bricks, my stack gets bigger. The stack that I have to pay rent on gets smaller. So rather than principal and interest, you have rent and equity purchase. And then the third piece of the agreement is that at any point during the 5 years or at the end of 5 years, you can purchase the home from the LLC at the then current market value, right? And that basically the design here is that once you have 10% of the equity built up, you can use that as a down payment for a traditional mortgage, right? And then use that mortgage to buy the home from the LLC in a non-competitive bid, right? You're not competing against anyone. You can take all the time you need. Get that mortgage in place, right? Get qualified. But the purchase is done at the then current value. So one of the core pieces and one of the pieces of innovation here is that we value each home every month, and the value of the bricks that is being traded, right, that the customer is buying over time, is based on the then current market value of the home. And the purchase option, right, at the end of 5 years is also at the then current market value. And so what that does for the investor, if I'm investing in those bricks, I get two things. One is I get rental income, right, on a fraction of the home. And two, I get the appreciation of those bricks, right? So if I'm a landlord in the traditional way, I'd buy the whole house, maybe finance it with debt. I hold it, you know, I get rental income, I get appreciation. What we're enabling through this construct of bricks is we're enabling the investor to get rental income and home price appreciation on as little as one brick, right, or 10 bricks, it's the current minimum, of an individual home. And so for the investor, right, it creates that real estate investment value proposition, but with a much lower entry point. in that, you know, you can buy 10 bricks in a $300,000 home. 10 bricks, you know, is a starting point of $300. So you can start investing in real estate with a much lower, you know, upfront investment than traditionally has been possible. So that's the construct. And so why does that work? Well, one, it gives the consumer, the first time buyer, an all cash offer. It gives them a partner that is a professional home buyer, right? Doing inspections, valuations, making sure that the property we're buying is an attractive property. We cover maintenance and repairs, insurance, property taxes, et cetera, for the first 5 years, right? But it gives the consumer payment certainty, right? There's no increase in the payment for the first 5 years, right? And so it really creates this in-between path between renting, which is the traditional path, and buying with a mortgage, right? And it makes it a lot easier for the customer to get into the market. And then on the investor side, the value prop is you can invest in that property. It's a lower, you know, entry point in terms of cost. And one of the things that we found since we started, which is really interesting, is the rental yield is above market, right? Because the product itself has benefits to the consumer. So we're getting very attractive rental yields. We're getting lower maintenance and repair costs because of that co-ownership mentality, right?
Right.
You don't have just a tenant living in the home. You have a co-owner who's taking care of it. And so we've seen that folks, you know, are fixing homes. They're, you know, repainting, they're replacing carpets. They're doing things that normally you would call your landlord and ask them to do it. They're doing it themselves as co-owners. And so obviously we're encouraging that through this equity ownership piece. And then ultimately, we believe that, you know, over time, that also contributes to the valuation and the appreciation of the property itself. So all else equal, creates a higher return for the investor, right? By having this partnership between the investor and the co-owner, i.e. the ONI, as we call them.
This is really, so I have so many questions. Bear with me for just a second. This is great. I'm processing this here. So let me live on the side of the homeowner for a moment, or the homeowner slash renter for a moment. So we've identified this home as the homeowner, and we've approached ONIFI, and there's some sort of approval process or something similar to a mortgage, I would assume, for them to qualify with their income and all that. And then you're going to say, okay, we're going to buy it for you. And we're going to set it up. Here's you know, you explain the brick concept and the rent my bricks versus buy my bricks, which I love the way you do that, because I think people can really understand that. The first time home buyer can probably understand that better than the GSE mortgage sheet that they get, right? And so you have this, and you value the home monthly. So it's valued at purchase, obviously. And then you have some sort of market index. And so the value of the 10,000 bricks is monthly adjustable. So it's kind of an adjustable rate mortgage, but not really. And so that the value adjusts over time. And so every month when I buy 13 bricks, I have to be ready that my payment might go up a little bit, or maybe I only buy 8 bricks this month or something like that, but I can figure that out. But over time, I can see the seesaw. Rather than it's the same as the principal interest seesaw, really, but it's more, you know, rented bricks versus owned bricks. You understand that. And over time, I at least have a path to get to 10% ownership. And then, of course, above and beyond that, so I guess the requirement is they get to 10% ownership. And above that, they have the option at any given time to buy the other 90% or portion of, right?
Correct.
Okay, exactly. I see. Right. So if you will, the 10% is analogous to the mortgage. You must pay these regardless, but the others, like, then once you get above and beyond, you're in better shape. So let's go to the investor side. And you mentioned as little as $300, right? So this is set up as some sort of exempt syndication or crowdfunding or something like that on the investment side, right?
So what we're doing is two pieces here. One is a Reg A exemption with the SEC
that allows us to sell
these bricks to any investor in the U.S., not just accredited investors, but any investor, right? Subject to obviously constraints and rules.
Mm-hmm.
And all that. And that, you know, that filing. That 1A filing is with the SEC. So, you know, it's visible. It's on our website. And we've been super transparent on that.
Yes.
The other piece we're doing is we're raising a fund, right? And that's a Reg D fund for accredited investors to invest across all of the homes and effectively have built-in diversification, right?
Got it.
And so one path is you can pick a home specifically to say, I know Chad, I trust him, I like the house he lives in. I want to invest in that house, right? And I want to buy bricks in that home. And the reason we set it up that way is that we have a strong thesis that the customers actually bring in their own, we call them circle of trust. So family members, friends, their community, their church, right? Where folks can co-invest into the home of someone they actually know, right? And we've seen a lot of folks who say, I want to invest in my community, right? Because I live here and I believe that home ownership is good for the community. So you can pick individual homes or you can invest in the fund to say, I like the construct. I like helping first-time buyers. I want to earn return, right? But I also want the diversification. Quite frankly, I don't want to bother picking individual homes. So, you know, you can do that through a fund as well.
Okay. So from the investor side, if I'm looking at this as like, wow, this is incredible socioeconomic and humanitarian benefit. Like this is do good while you do well, like to a T, right? And so this is wonderful. And so as an investor, I could be a non-accredited investor with as little as maybe $300 or whatever the number is at the time. And I would invest in the Reg A fund, which, you know, is advertised and all that. And then you're also sophisticated enough where I could say, I want to invest in my son's home or whatever. And from that fund, you could divert those funds to the right sub LLC, if you will. Okay, I see. And then on the other side, if I'm an accredited investor and I want to invest $500,000 in this, I just go into the Reg D fund. And then similarly, you could divert me to a geographical area or an individual or a group of individuals or things. So that's right there is sophistication in how you're allocating the funds. I mean, I don't want to gloss over that at all. So incredible. Did I get that right?
Yeah, no, you got it exactly right. And so the whole idea here is, right, this is a double bottom line investment in that we're monetizing the asset in a way that generates good return, but we're also solving this problem, right, which is homes are being snapped up by institutional buyers and we're preventing people from building a path to ownership, right? So if we can kind of bring the community together to help solve that, that's the core mission.
This is fantastic. And so folks, I just mentioned this is socioeconomic and humanitarian benefit. This is great for the first time home buyer. I'm going to go on a limb and say that the cost per bricks for rental and acquiring that they're paying is probably going to be a better ratio than the mortgage they would be paying at any given time. But they're at least building towards ownership. And so let's go back to the investor hat. I see a lot of ways this is great. What, you know, I'm a typical rental investor. I understand how rentals work and debt and all that kind of stuff. You're not putting debt on the property, so default is not a risk. But what are the risks as an investor, or and how do you mitigate them with, you know, the rules in the LLC and the lease agreement and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So this is where the time at FICO and at NOMIS and, you know, the being in the bowels of mortgage math kind of really, really paid off, I think. So what we've built here to, if you think about it from an investor perspective, there is the risk around the customer, right? So does the ONI default and not pay, and you have to evict that customer? Do you have to go through some sort of bad scenario?
So default, is that just not paying the rental cost, or is that not paying the rental and buying the 13 bricks? Like, what constitutes a default?
It could be either, right?
Either. Okay.
Yeah. And so at the end of the day, it's, you know, does the customer live up to their obligations? And so what we've done there is we've built an underwriting engine, right? And we look at a couple of thousand pieces of data for each individual applicant. And today we're accepting about 1% of the applicants. So what that means is that if you look at our portfolio right now, the average FICO score is 744, right?
Oh, okay.
So these are folks who have pristine credit, but they don't have the savings for the down payment, which is really the hurdle we're solving for, right?
Yeah.
They have great incomes. They have student debt, as I described earlier, right? They have good jobs. And so far, we've had zero payment default, right, because of that. So what we're focused on is very much generating good customers in terms of their credit profile, right?
So at least right now, you are underwriting to a early but highly productive member of society. This is someone who cares about making their payments. They care about their credit. They've got a good job, maybe saddled with too much student debt. In a few years, they'll get that taken care of. This is the kind of person that exactly. really benefits. Yeah, I see. Okay.
Yeah. If you think about the hurdle, right, for the first time buyer, it's generally three things. One is income, very hard to solve for. If you don't make enough money, buying a home will always be hard. Two is credit, right? If you haven't managed your credit, you're not paying your bills on time and you have poor credit, you can't get a mortgage. You also can't get Onify to help you, right? Because that is a risky proposition for any investor.
Yeah.
And then the third hurdle is the down payment. And that's quite frankly the biggest hurdle and the one that we're helping first-time buyers overcome.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
So then the second risk, if you think about it from an investor perspective, is you have a default risk, right? And you can mitigate that by underwriting customers. And you can mitigate it through the product structure itself. And this is why building this as equity and bricks is important compared to a mortgage. The risk that you had in mortgages, zero down mortgages, we go back to 2007, 2008, 2009, is that as soon as home prices fall a little bit, right, you have someone with a $300,000 mortgage and their house is worth $250,000, they look at it and go, well, I'm underwater. I'm just going to mail the keys back to the bank, right? They call it the jingle mail, right? Strategic defaults. And people walk away. In the way we've built Onify, this product, is the customer builds equity, right? And there's no debt in the stack. And so if the home price falls, right, as a customer, I have 2% on day one. That's what I put down. And then I build to 3% and 4% and 5% and 6%. But that sliver of equity is still worth whatever it's worth, even if home prices fall. So you don't have this risk of the customer saying, hey, I'm just going to, you know, not live up to my obligations, because they have that investment in the stack alongside the investors as well. And so then the third risk is obviously home price appreciation or the asset risk itself, right? You buy a house and it either doesn't appreciate or it depreciates. And that's where a lot of the focus for us has been on picking the right markets, right, that have long-term structural economic drivers, i.e. growth, income creation, job creation, people moving, right, which is driving home prices. And we look at individual assets and do, a valuation process where we look at the individual homes to make sure these are assets that increase in value. And so if you think about, you know, kind of the average return for single family rental investment unlevered is 8.3% long run, right? And it's usually half is appreciation and half is current yield, right? And what we're doing is we've generated somewhere around 11.5% because we're picking properties that have above average appreciation, and we're picking properties that have, you know, slightly higher rental yield, and we're trying to kind of hit the middle, right, where both components, you have appreciation and current yield, where those two things balance themselves. And if you do that right, then you can minimize the investor risk, especially if you don't have leverage in the stack, right, because the downside is right. unlimited. So that's been the value prop and the pitch to the investor community out there.
Yeah, and I would go so far as to use the term asymmetric risk on this, because you are the ultimate owner. So the good thing is, and let's, you know, all things being equal, typical housing market, this will work well. Let's stress test it for a moment together. So let's just pretend that we're doing this in 2007, right? We all know what happened, right? And so number one risk was, well, gee, my home is now worth less than my mortgage. I may have loans getting called. That doesn't happen because you own the entity controls and owns all of the home that the homeowner doesn't have. Now, let's say that you do get in a situation where the home is worth less than what you have in it. You know, values are down 30%. Let's just say that, right? So, okay, yep. The ownership situation, yes, it's underwater. Are you selling it? No. So that's not really as big of an issue. But what does change is your monthly valuation model. And so what I'm thinking of here is, okay, the returns on that home or the portfolio or whatever in a heavy deleveraging situation where, by the way, everything is off, if you know nothing is making a lot of money, but yep. your downside risk is limited, but you probably do feel a little bit of reduced return because, and I guess this is the great if the homeowner happens to have enough cash or consistent cash to acquire as many bricks as he can. And let's say he or she is smart and realizes, hey, my home value is down 30 or 40%. I better buy as many bricks as I can today. Let's just assume they're that smart. You know, how does that affect the investment? Or is that really am I stacking too many unlikely situations together? You know what I'm saying?
No. And what we've done, Chad, is exactly what you're describing, which is we ran something like 35,000 different simulations, right? Mm-hmm. And we said, okay, what if we did this in December of 2005 and in January of 2006 and, you know, every month throughout the cycle? And so there's a couple of things that that are at play here that come together. One is we have a five-year commitment, right? So a five-year hold period. And if you look over a five-year hold period, generally, even during that, call it 07 through 2012 period, unless you were in the Inland Empire or in some parts of Florida, right? In the markets that we're in, you would have made money. You would have seen, you know, if not appreciation, at least flat values over that whole period, right? And that's where the hold period helps. And as you say,
so there's the downside risk. You're mitigating the downside risk, right?
You're mitigating the downside risk. Then structurally, what the product allows the customer to do is build up to 10% equity, but we cap them at 10%. So even if home prices fall, right, for the customer, what's interesting here is the customer is basically buying the home like through dollar cost averaging, right? If home prices fall, they're actually buying slightly more bricks every month.
Right.
So think of this as, you know, you invest in a mutual fund, you make your fixed payment, and you're buying more and, you know, higher number of shares in those months where home prices fall. So the customer builds equity faster, which is good for them, right? But they're capped at 10%. So they can't just go out and buy, you know, 50% at a reduced price. And then the third piece in the product design is that the call option on the home, remember when we said earlier, the customer can buy the home from the investor, from the LLC, at market value. However, there's a floor at least 5% above the entry price. So really the call option is at market or 5% above entry, whichever is higher, right? And that, again, puts a downside protection in place for the investor to say, I cannot get bought out because there's a fluke devaluation, right? Or the market crashes in whatever, you know, particular town I'm in.
I love that you thought through all of this. And so, like, by the way, this is a man after my own heart. He is a good, he does math well, and he's modeled lots of scenarios. That speaks volumes to me as an investor. And so, okay. So just to reiterate what you just said, this just talking to real estate investors here, this kind of, not really, but it kind of at the most basic fundamental level resembles a lease option where they're renting the house technically from the LLC, but they have an option with certain restrictions to purchase it at any time. So monthly, they have the ability to buy up to 10%. They can't just say, hey, I'm going to throw an extra $10,000 at this and buy another 10%. That's under the call option. And so the call option is then limited to 95%, or was it 95 or 105% of initial value, 5% more or less? What was it?
5% more.
Okay, so it's limited to 105% of initial valuation, which makes sense because in an option agreement, you set the value to protect your downside. But they can't in that call option, can the home buyer, let's say they now own 10%, can he go buy 40%, or must the call option be for the entire 90? The
call option is for the entire 90.
There it is. There's the protection. Okay. So basically they get to own the home, build equity, you know, not have to worry about the initial down payment, all the while they can have the home and be saving the down payment. And then when the time is right in the credit markets, pull the trigger on a conventional mortgage or something of that sort, but the home they already own and don't have to compete for. And then boom, I see, exactly. Man, I see the vision, you know, it's incredible. So, well, I could talk about this all day, folks, but I'm looking at our clock and we're already at 41 minutes after the hour. So Frank, I want to give you the opportunity because I know most people can't handle this question, but I'm going to give it to you. What did we not talk about that we need to on this structure from an investor or a home buyer perspective?
I think we covered everything. The one piece you mentioned, it kind of, there's a double bottom line here, right? And there's an economic benefit. There's also a societal benefit. So one of the things we've done is we've qualified Ownify through a partner to be a DAF eligible investment, donor advised fund investment. So you can actually use charitable capital,
yeah,
right, to put into the fund to support this mission of homeownership. And you know, one of the things we're working on is allowing investors to then say, okay, I care about these causes, right? I care about these regions. I care about you know, segments that I want to help. How do I funnel capital into those causes specifically? So that's still, you know, something we're working on, but we're really looking to acquire and attract capital that then also catalyzes market rate capital through this DAF option.
And folks, if you haven't discovered donor advised funds, go look at my prior episode on those, or reach out. They are incredible tools if you have the means to be charitable, and puts the, you know, you can have a foundation without the infrastructure of running a foundation. It's just incredible, you know. So yeah. Let's get to the Quattro questions. We've got 3 minutes to get through these, and then I've got to let Frank get back to running this amazing new company that he's built. Frank, superpower. What is your superpower in life or business, and how does it serve you well? He's ripping off his shirt right now for those not watching us. You know,
you know, it's a good question. I think the math piece, right, and really digging into how does financing work, right? The back to 15 years in the bowels of mortgage math and pricing, right? Building a pricing engine. So that is, I don't know if it's a superpower that is, you know, attractive in the kind of, you know, you go to a cocktail party and it's like, hey, my superpower is mortgage math. But it is for this purpose.
That'll get him a day.
My superpower, right? And so I'm happy that I found a way to use that skill to do good in the world. Right? And that's maybe the other one, is trying to combine and use that not just to make money for, you know, me and investors, but for, you know, helping solve a real problem out there. And you know, that's been, honestly, the biggest win is having the conversations with the first-time buyers that we're helping and seeing how their eyes light up and how excited they are to be in homes, right, where they didn't think that was possible. And so combining those two.
I love it. I have no further thing to add. That was perfect. Mic drop it right there. Let's flip the coin over, Frank. What is your, you mentioned in the beginning we had one, but what's your biggest failure, life or business? And most importantly, what's the lesson you garnered from it?
You know, it's interesting. I when you first asked this, you know, the podcast title is Real Estate Runway. It is runway. It's having runway, right? That is so important. Having the optionality to say, yeah, what we're building is hard. Any business you build is hard. It never goes according to plan, right? And so having the runway, which ultimately means the funding, right? And the emotional and intellectual stamina to work through what are the obstacles that are out there, right? You need both. And, you know, I do a fair amount of advisory work with, you know, younger entrepreneurs and startup founders. And I always coach them that, you know, building a business is like running a marathon. So you got to have runway, you got to have stamina, you got to have gas in the tank. And you don't want to run your first half faster than the second half, right? If you've ever done long distance running, right, that negative split of having enough to make it across the finish line, that's super important, right? So ultimately, that's about, you know, raising enough capital and having the runway and having the prudent financial picture, but also having the, you know, the fortitude to kind of stay the course, right? Or pivot as you have to, but, you know, keep that gas in the tank.
I love that you went there, and I was hoping you would. Folks, runway, and I've never thought of it this way, but runway is gas in the tank, funding, cash. Cash flow moves a lot slower than cash. We just beat this dead horse in an episode with Travis Balcom talking about self-storage. And I think it's the one just prior to this, depending when this one gets released. But folks, internalize that. Runway. And I love the way you said it. Cash equals runway. Funding equals runway. Time for the shameless plug. And I don't even think it needs to be shameless. This is so good. I want you to talk about it. Tell us how we can get involved with Ownify if we're an investor or a home buyer, and any other free stuff or podcasts or anything else you want to mention here, please do it now.
Yeah. As a home buyer, come to Ownify, get qualified. If we're not in your market yet, join the wait list and we'd love to come to your market. As an investor, come to Ownify, you know, and sign up for either the fund or directly into a property. You can get accredited and qualified or accredited. And again, this is not a solicitation, right? We're going to do all this per the SEC guidelines. So read the materials but you know, come check us out. That's the plug. And I know it's shameless, but that is the, you know, the thing I'm excited about and probably the best way you can get involved and help.
Team listeners, you hear me always talk about doing good while doing well. Well, this is it. I'm so excited about this episode today, Frank. It's not even funny. So, okay. Last one. Here at Quattro, we are big on philanthropy as one of our four pillars. After all, that is people, property, profits, and philanthropy, a group of people coming together around property to generate profits, some of which are used for philanthropy, coming back and taking care of people. It's a circle, right? So yep. I love to give my guests an opportunity to just talk about your philanthropic heart, where you give your time, your talent, your treasures, arguably your business is this, you know, as it was qualified for a DAF. But what is that for you? You know, where do you give back, Frank?
I mostly through advisory work. So I'm part of a network here in Silicon Valley called The Alchemist that helps first-time founders and young entrepreneurs kind of think through, you know, how do you build a business? What are all the challenges? So that's just volunteer work, a couple hours a week. I do fundraising. And my favorite charity, and this is the other maybe shameless plug, is a charity called Room to Read. That it's a place that builds libraries in sub-Saharan Africa, in poorer countries in Southeast Asia. And the idea is that you can fund an individual library for as little as $20,000, right? Have it staffed and give access to books to children in countries and in places where they don't have that, right? So very, very powerful, because I think education is so important and so powerful, right, in lifting people out of poverty. So that's a favorite one. Those are the two.
Incredible. Frank, this has been a pleasure of an episode. I'm so glad that you found our show, because this is a very noteworthy topic, very noteworthy problem to solve, and a very creative solution to it. I hope you'll come back to the show in 6 months or a year and just, you know, tell us how it's going. You know, I'd love to hear the progress and the lives you've touched. So thank you for coming on, sharing your time and your knowledge, and, we'll see you in 6 months, I hope.
Cool. Thanks, Chad. Really nice chatting and glad to be here.
All right, everyone. This has been another episode of the Real Estate Runway podcast. As we mentioned earlier, if you got any value out of this show, especially, or any other show that we do, swipe it, like it, share it, subscribe to it. Just do something so the algorithm knows you liked it, and pay it forward, folks. Until next time, this has been another episode of the Real Estate Runway podcast. Over and out.
We hope this episode was insightful and brought value to your day. If so, please be awesome and leave us a 5-star review. Find out how Team Quattro can help you at thequattroway.com and scroll down for more info. Until next time, this is the Real Estate Runway podcast.